We have two cases today. Before we begin, I'd like to welcome back Senior Judge Ryan to the bench. We're very appreciative of the fact that she's sitting here today. Our first case is United States v. Horn. Captain Bosner, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Captain Budzinski, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I'm Captain David Bosner, and along with my co-counsel, Major Ryan Cirkovich, represent the appellant in this case, Staff Sergeant Brandon Horn. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes in rebuttal.
Granted.
The actions of the trial counsel and the Special Victims Counsel were not merely unwise or inadvisable, they're intolerable. This was an orchestrated effort undertaken by two JAGs occupying two different roles, which influenced the military justice process itself. When Captain A.S. notified the SBC of her success in accomplishing his objective, he wrote back, "Wow, that's great news. Thank you for getting that done." A member of the public would harbor significant doubt about the fairness of the proceedings if they were to learn that a prosecutor representing the United States of America, at the request of the personal attorney for an accuser, influenced independent investigators to abandon a lead on evidence thought to be exculpatory in nature. Foregoing this exculpatory lead was an acceptable consequence to keep the named victim as a willing participant, to keep the not-yet-started prosecution alive. As articulated in Boyce, this damages the public's perception of the fairness of the system as a whole. And this strain is intolerable, or more accurately, the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there is no strain, because these are JAGs, trained legal professionals and military officers, each with an independent duty to uphold the integrity of the military justice system.
Can I raise something from page 38 of your brief? So there's two sentences here. You say the husband's interview could have better informed trial defense counsel's cross-examination of the named victim or led to the discovery of additional helpful evidence. And the interview may have permitted the defense to impeach the husband on a prior inconsistent statement or offer a statement as a prior recollection recorded. And in fact, as you indicate in your brief, you're in a difficult position in terms of trying to prove what might have been. You're trying to prove an alternative history. But at the same time, that could appear as really speculative. How do we make a distinction between this approach that could be viewed as highly speculative as compared to essentially saying that instead of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, there's strict liability imposed on a case like this? What can you point to in the record that would demonstrate that, in fact, if OSI had interviewed the husband earlier, it would have made some kind of difference?
Yes, Your Honor. The best thing I can point to in the record is that in the OSI agent notes, when the husband was interviewed in relation to the investigation of his wife as the suspect, he did recall speaking with his wife on the night in question, and that was in March of 2018. Now, when we get to motions practice in May of 2018, in the motions practice under oath, the husband is now unable to recall the contents of the phone call or even that there was one. So if there was a loss of memory, it occurred between March 2018 and May 2018. And this directly refutes the military judge's finding of fact, which we contend is clearly erroneous, that an earlier pretrial interview would not have yielded appreciable information.
Okay. However, do you dispute the notion that the husband was a peripheral witness here?
Yes, Your Honor, we do dispute that. He need not have been in Germany on the night in question. He is more than a peripheral witness, because this case, as noted in the majority opinion of the CCA, as well as very strictly reviewed in the dissent, the credibility of this complaining witness in this case was highly, there were questions about her credibility, such that The dissent was not convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that my client was, in fact, guilty. The majority also reserved, highlighted their reservations about her credibility as well. So when we have evidence thought to be exculpatory in nature in the text message, we also have a phone call.
Now, is that really exculpatory? I mean, it goes to show that in that context, within the personal relationship, she was less than honest. But is that truly exculpatory?
Captain A.S. believed it was exculpatory, and she says that in her motions testimony. And when the prosecutor believes, Your Honor, that there's exculpatory information out there, that puts an affirmative obligation on the prosecutor to go and obtain that evidence, disclose its existence, and disclose its content.
Okay, but let's stay a little bit focused on the point I'm trying to get to in terms of what we would point to that would indicate that the fact that there was not an earlier interview really mattered. Are you pointing to the outcry nature of the potential evidence that could have been given by the husband?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the starting point. The outcry phone call, of which there was no recorded recollection of what occurred in that phone call. And per this court's decision, United States versus Stellato, the duty that's put on the trial counsel is when the evidence reasonably tends to be exculpatory in nature. So when you combine the text message that was later introduced into evidence as Defense Exhibit B with the complaining witness's reluctance to have her husband contacted and interviewed, it reasonably tends to demonstrate, or there is at least a reasonable inference, that the contents of that phone call also reasonably tended to be exculpatory in nature.
But isn't part of the problem here that it wasn't a situation where OSI was swooping in immediately after the allegations were made known to OSI? There was even a three-month gap before they were trying to interview the husband. So in terms of any type of memory issues that might have impeded this, or collusion or decision to invoke the spousal privilege, wouldn't that have all occurred during this three-month period anyways?
At least some of that would have occurred within that three-month period, Your Honor. However, it is fair to say that the closer in time to July 2017 that this interview happened, the more likely that the husband would have been able to recall what happened here. And we at least have something to point to in the record that says he did remember the phone call around the time the interview was canceled, and he only forgot it sometime between March and May 2018. And this highlights some of the concern, Chief Judge Olson, from your first question about speculation and what would he have known, when did he forget it, and what can we gather from that. As this court articulated in Salyer, an effects-based prejudice analysis is hard to engage in because of the way this works. We don't know what was lost, when was lost, or how it was lost, but all change has some effect. And in this apparent UCI case, where the appellant has no burden to demonstrate personal prejudice, the government's brief discusses appellant's inability to show personal prejudice. But he has no ability or no requirement to do so. We can point to some in the record where personal prejudice does matter. But it's about the public as a whole and their distrust in the military justice system as a whole because of what happened here. That's the prejudice in the legacy of United States versus Boyce. And when a member of the public, fully informed of all the facts and circumstances of this case, reviews the record of trial and looks at it, the primary aspect of the intolerable strain has really three different aspects to it. And the way that I view it is there's a Venn diagram of three circles. And this case is right in the heart of all of it. The first is that you have a prosecutor who is willing to turn her back to potentially exculpatory information. You have investigators who want to go out and do an interview that they believe is relevant and necessary to their investigation, but yield to the trial counsel. And third, you have a victim or a victim's counsel who pressures OSI, doesn't get what he wants, but then indirectly through the trial counsel achieves his objective. And all three of those things happen here. And this case sits in the center of that Venn diagram, such that what we have is the victim's insistence or the victim's preference to not have certain evidence collected through whatever mechanisms that happened. That's what resulted here. And a member of the public would harbor significant doubt if a witness or the complaining witness is able to determine what evidence is collected and what evidence is not collected.
Counsel, what could the government have done differently in this situation? Let's just say we agree with you that this investigation went off the rails early on. Was it irreparably tainted at that point? Because the husband was eventually interviewed. Trial counsel was replaced. The special victims counsel was replaced. The entire UCI question was litigated and decided at the trial stage. What more could the government have done to correct the errors that happened early on in the investigation stage, if anything? Or is it your view that there was nothing they could have done?
Judge Hardy, I believe if the government had realized that even if OSI didn't go and accomplish that interview in October of 2017, the trial counsel should have. When discovery obligations attached, at least in February of 2018, and the trial counsel still subjectively believed that there was exculpatory information out there, full discovery obligations ensued. And at that point, even if OSI hadn't done their due diligence, the government should have gone out, interviewed the husband, disclosed the existence of the information, disclosed the contents of the information to the defense. What we have is the government doesn't even interview the husband until the eve of motions practice. They respond in writing to the defense's motion and claim before the trial court that there's no actual or apparent UCI without even talking to the husband. And that's hard to understand how the government is able to make such a declaration before even knowing what he knew.
Captain Bosner, wasn't there another witness who saw what the victim in this case was doing with her phone at the time she texted her husband?
Yes, Your Honor. Her name was Staff Sergeant Cochran.
Right, but wasn't she available to testify, and didn't the investigators already know kind of the substance of what was texted or messaged between the victim and her husband?
Yes, Judge Sparks, that's how this information comes to light initially, where we have initial interviews of this witness who is also the victim in the allegation where the named victim in our case is the suspect. She does witness on the patio of the hotel that this text message is happening. The point that never comes through, but we can start to see it in the defense's supplemental motion in their first footnote, is although there's an awareness of this text message being out there, the defense doesn't have it yet. The defense only gets it later. So Captain A.S.'s motions testimony that this information was already out there hardly satisfies the government's discovery obligations, which, as I mentioned earlier, under Stellato, would require that the existence and the contents be disclosed to the defense, and that didn't happen.
Well, isn't the remedy for not having gotten proper discovery, at least one remedy, is to simply request a continuance so that you can evaluate the evidence or the discovery?
Your Honor, that's certainly one thing that could have happened, was a request for a continuance. By the time we get to May 2018, however, when it's clear at that point the husband doesn't know anything about conversations he previously had, there's no reasonable likelihood that a continuance would have yielded appreciable information from the witness.
So, counsel, based on some of the questions from my colleagues, I have just a bottom line question. Is it your position that once some appearance of unlawful command influence appears, that nothing can cure it, that basically it is a strict liability offense, and that Boyce said that?
No, Senior Judge Ryan, that's not our position. There are things that can cure it, but nothing.
Well, but you've said, and you've said in your brief, and you've said here today, that no prejudice whatsoever is required, and that the ameliorative measures that the government took prior to trial and the actions of the judge at trial, that none of that matters.
Senior Judge Ryan, it's not that none of it matters. It's nothing dissipates the taint in the eyes of the public.
Well, that's the same thing as nothing matters, that nothing can be done, that is a strict liability offense.
That's
not our... cannot be dissipated.
That's not our position, Your Honor. Had, as in response to Judge Hardy's question, I believe if the government had taken proactive steps in recognizing their discovery responsibility and gone out and interviewed the husband in February of 2018 themselves, that certainly would have helped. If the stat judge advocate...
But if interviewing him then, earlier, then he doesn't matter, what difference does it make?
Your Honor, I do believe that interviewing him earlier... in the case would have mattered. And as a point we brought out in our reply brief, the military judge's finding of fact that an earlier interview would not have helped the defense, we believe is clearly erroneous because at some point he did. So if discovery obligations attached in February of 2018 upon referral and service on the accused, and in March of 2018, the husband interviews with OSI and recalls this, there's a period in time there where the government could have done something about it. Also, if the staff judge advocate had recognized how this transpired between the end of 2017 and early 2018, she could have removed the trial counsel earlier, which would help.
But all of this is that you are discussing now is entirely speculative. Like, it's entirely speculative. Could have, should have, might have.
Chief Judge Olson, I see my time has expired. May I please respond? Senior Judge Ryan. Senior Judge Ryan, it is hard to articulate when the husband forgot what he knew. We can point to something in the record that he did forget something he knew. We can also point in the record that there's personal prejudice because the named victim participated, which she said she would not have done but for her husband. The interview of her husband going away. So there's at least some personal prejudice we can point to. Our main position is that this case lives in the analytical legacy of Boyce, where if the public looks at this as a whole, fully informed of all the facts and circumstances, they would harbor significant doubt about the fairness of the system.
Thank you. General Brzezinski.
Chief Judge Olson, Senior Judge Ryan, members of the court, may it please the court. I am Captain Cortland Bobchinski, and I, along with my co-counsel, Colonel Naomi Dennis, represent the United States government. This court should affirm the holding of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. The appellant claims that an intolerable strain was created when the former SVC and trial counsel directed OSI not to interview Tech Sergeant VC. But their actions did not render the appellant's court-martial unfair because the exculpatory evidence related to Tech Sergeant BC was provided to the defense prior to the Article 32 hearing. Tech Sergeant BC was interviewed as a witness. He was produced as a witness at the pretrial motions hearing.
Could you speak up just a little bit, please?
Yes, Your Honor. OSI interviewed Tech Sergeant BC in relation to his wife's investigation, and that information was provided to the defense. And the military judge found as a finding of fact that there was no evidence lost due to OSI not interviewing Tech Sergeant BC in October of 2017. Even so, the government took extensive ameliorative steps by promptly removing the trial counsel in her role, turning over all relevant communications to the defense, reviewing all of Captain AS's work product in order to make sure it was in compliance with its discovery obligations, as well as fully litigating a UCI motion. On top of all of that, the military judge then even granted one of the appellant's requested remedies, which was to expand the cross-examination of the victim and ask about her role in interfering with an OSI investigation. And the military judge even reordered that the untainted trial counsel re-review Captain AS's work product in order to, again, make sure that it was in compliance with its discovery obligation.
So, Captain Bochinski, are you conceding that there is at least some evidence that the some evidence prong of UCI has been met here?
Yes, Your Honor. It is a particularly low burden for the appellant.
Speaking for myself alone, that's a wise and constructive move on the part of the government. So let's just focus on what happened here. You've got the trial counsel emailing OSI in Germany and saying, quote, I completely understand why the husband is being interviewed. Then, when she's being questioned in the course of litigation here, she's asked, did you feel like the victim's husband had any exculpatory evidence? And her response is, we did. Why isn't this a particularly damning set of facts here?
Your Honor, the record does demonstrate that Captain A.S. did not intend to hide exculpatory evidence or even to turn a blind eye towards exculpatory evidence.
Okay, but intent isn't the key here, is it?
No, Your Honor, I think that this court certainly can consider it, but I think when we're looking at did Captain A.S. admit to, you know, knowing that there's exculpatory evidence and then taking steps to direct OSI not to interview them, I do think that intent then does matter. And if you look at what she then clarifies what she meant by that, she says that evidence was already out there, referring to the content of the text message sent from the victim to her husband, Tech Sergeant VC, and then says it was contained in another witness's statement. And that statement, which was Staff Sergeant Elsie's written statement, was provided to the defense before the Article 32 hearing.
But aren't there two facets here of the evidentiary issue? One is the text message, where she clearly intentionally misled her husband about her own conduct, but then also seeking to find out what the victim had said to her husband about the alleged assault, the outcry aspect of this. How was anyone else privy to that other than the husband?
Your Honor, the defense had at least knowledge that he was an outcry witness by January 4th of 2018. They received the victim's written statement in which she discusses telling her husband about this outcry evidence. And the defense could have interviewed him at any point thereafter regarding what he specifically heard from his wife. In fact,
that's a little bit of a, yeah, but what about you? Argument. I mean, here the responsibility is for OSI. They want to interview. It's very clear from the OSI's written emails in the terms of the exchange. They think it's necessary and appropriate to interview the husband. And yet the SVC dramatically inserts himself into this process and prevents that from occurring. That's the issue here, not the missteps of, potential missteps, perceived missteps of the defense. It's what was the government doing here?
Certainly, Your Honor, this court can consider it, but also should be considering the lack of prejudice. As this court stated in United States versus Boyce, it is a significant factor that is given considerable weight when we're determining intolerable strain. And the fact that the military judge found as a finding of fact that there was no evidence lost, and the fact that he was interviewed by the defense and he was called as a witness, and the defense had access to him at any time, and they knew that he was an outcry witness, demonstrates that there was no impact to the fairness of his proceedings and that he was not personally prejudiced.
Counsel, on the point that the military judge found that nothing was lost, counsel for the appellant says that that finding is clearly erroneous. What's the government's response?
Your Honor, when you're looking at what Tech Sergeant VC specifically said he could not recall, there's only one time that he says he does not remember in relation to the charged offense, the substantive matter, that OSI undoubtedly would have interviewed him on. And that's the content of the text message that he received from the victim. And as soon as he says he does not remember, he then accurately summarizes the content of that message. But even if he hadn't remembered it, that content of that message was already contained in another witness's statement in which he not only discussed the content of that message, but the context as well, which Tech Sergeant VC would not have been able to provide as he was not on the other side of that text message when Staff Sergeant LC was in fact there. The appellant does point to a question in which he was asked what he specifically told OSI in relation to the outcry evidence. That is a matter relating to the interlocutory matter, not the charged offense. The defense had an opportunity to ask him what he specifically told to his wife, but they didn't ask that. They could have demonstrated on the record that he either remembered what his wife told him or that he forgot, and that it was connected to the period in time in which OSI would have interviewed him and when the defense received that information on January 4th of 2018. So, in fact, there's nothing in the record that shows that the military judge's finding of fact was clearly erroneous. Your Honor, in conjunction with the fact that there is no personal prejudice and there is no evidence that Captain A.S. or Captain J.P.'s actions would have impacted the appellant's court-martial, we also have extensive remedial steps by the government, as well as the military judge. As this court stated in United States v. Simpson, the government can demonstrate that the taint of unlawful command influence can be removed through ameliorative steps, specifically discovery and a fully litigated pretrial motion. And that's exactly what occurred here. We have comprehensive discovery in which all of the communications on this matter from Captain A.S. to Captain J.P. to OSI was provided to the defense, and there was a fully litigated motions hearing, which is this court has recognized in cases like United States versus Rivers and United States versus Bogossi and United States versus Simpson. A fully litigated pretrial motion can be used to delineate the scope and impact of unlawful command influence. And here, that's exactly what occurred. The actions of Captain A.S. and Captain J.P. were fully delineated, and the scope and the impact of that was fully explored on a public hearing, thereby demonstrating that there would not be a continued perception of unfairness, and that, in fact, those actions had been remedied long before the appellant's court-martial.
I mean, it seems, counsel, like understanding that Riesbeck was an actual unlawful command influence case, and part of the problem in that case was that while the issue was raised multiple times, nothing was done. And this case seems to be on the opposite side of the spectrum. Would you agree with that? In terms of the fact that the issue was raised, it was litigated, corrective measures were taken, and all of that would be available and known to a reasonable member of the public.
Yes, Your Honor. And as this court stated in United States versus Simpson, it certainly depends on the nature of the claim. But if I could liken this case to United States versus Douglas, as well as United States versus Bogossi, and understanding that United States versus Douglas had a different outcome, but this court did provide excellent analysis in that those cases were centered on the UCI discouraging witnesses from participating at trial. And those actions had been remedied, and they had been appropriately remedied. Unfortunately, in United States versus Douglas, there wasn't any evidence to show that that remedy, which this court noted was appropriate, had actually been executed. But given the similar nature that we're discussing a witness being present or participating in a court-martial, and the fact that that had been remedied and those witnesses were then able to participate in the court-martial, kind of demonstrates the fact that, you know, even if there is unlawful command influence, there's, given the nature of the claim, there still can be successful ameliorative steps to make sure that there is not going to be a taint of unfairness. But in conjunction with the fact that there was a pretrial motions hearing as well as discovery, the government also made sure that Captain A.S. was removed by the first pretrial motions hearing and that she was replaced with an untainted trial counsel. And in fact, her work product was reviewed by the untainted trial counsel, and the trial counsel ensured the judge that they were going to be in compliance with their discovery obligation, and the military judge even followed up with that in ordering the trial counsel to re-review and to make sure that anything that was inconsistent in her work product would be handed over to the defense. And then in conjunction with that, the military judge even granted one of the appellant's requested remedies, which was to expand the scope of cross-examination of the victim and allow the defense to ask her questions about her role in interfering with the OSI's investigation. And as this court stated in United States versus Douglas, it took note of when an appellant actually takes an active participatory role in a remedy, and that's exactly what occurred here. So the appellant did get that benefit. And honestly, in looking at this case, as soon as the military justice system became aware of this situation, it did, the government as well as the military judge did everything in its power and everything possible to make sure that that would be rectified and that there would not be this perception or this taint of unfairness. And so, Your Honor, barring any further questions.
I have a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your brief and in the appellant's brief, you trade claims about what a reasonable member of the public, fully informed, would perceive. And my question is, are these factual claims or are they normative claims? A reasonable member of the public should feel that or should perceive that the military justice system is tainted, or is it that a reasonable member of the public, if we gave this information and we polled the public, in fact, they would perceive this? And the reason I ask this is, if it's a factual claim, how do we know what the facts are, whether they would or would not feel that there was an unreasonable strain? Are we just guessing? Is there anything in the record that helps us with that? And if it's a normative claim, what is the basis upon which we make that normative claim? In other words, there's half a dozen well-articulated, maybe more, claims about what a reasonable member of the public would perceive in appellant's brief, and you respond to those, and you've done that now. But what are these claims? Are they factual claims? Because there's no evidence in the record about what a reasonable member of the public believes. We don't have an expert testimony. We don't have a polling data. So that would have to just be speculation on our part or informed guesswork, I suppose. Or is it normative about what should a reasonable member of the public feel?
Your Honor, I think that it is very much fact determinative, and as this court has indicated in cases like United States versus Proctor, it is a fact-intensive inquiry. And so there is nothing in the record or in the military judge's finding of fact that suggests what the public at large would have assumed. So, Your Honor, I do think that this court looks to the facts from the record and specifically at what the military judge found in his finding of fact. And in looking at these facts, there is nothing that suggests that there would have been any impact upon the appellant's court-martial or that his proceedings would have been rendered unfair in any way. And the ultimate question before this court is whether or not a disinterested, objective observer of the public, aware of all of the facts and circumstances of this case, would harbor a significant doubt about the fairness of the appellant's proceedings. And in looking at the facts of this case, there's nothing that suggests that.
Do you have any insight or comment as to Congress's amendment to Article 37? Where they require actual prejudice to the accused, and what, if any, bearing that has on our apparent unlawful command influence doctrine?
Your Honor, I think that it certainly doesn't necessarily affect this case. However, I do think it is insightful, and, Your Honor, I do agree with your dissenting opinion, United States versus Boyce, discussing that there does need to be a tethering to Article 59A, and so it seems that Congress has adopted that view. However, it wouldn't necessarily have any bearing to this court's analysis on this case.
Because of the timing.
Yes, Your Honor.
Further questions? Thank you. Counsel?
It's the government's burden to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that there's no intolerable strain in this case. What a member of the public would see is a victim who does not want her husband interviewed. This is a victim who was also the subject of an investigation by the same OSI detachment. A member of the public would see a special victims counsel trying to change what an independent law enforcement agency is doing in their investigation. A member of the public would see that victim's counsel goes to the trial counsel, and the trial counsel succeeds in accomplishing the initial objective in getting the interview canceled.
Strange question, perhaps, but the Special Victims Council's job, right, in part, is to advocate on behalf of the victim, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if the victim says to Special Victims Council, I will be very upset if my husband is interviewed and I won't proceed I will not participate in these proceedings, what then is the Special Victims Council to do?
What does Special Victims Council can't?
Because, I mean, because it's a strange construct. Right? We now have a three-party system, right, where we have the trial counsel advocating for the government, right, and the defense counsel advocating for the defendant, and the Special Victims Council advocating for the special for the victim.
Yes, right? Senior Judge Ryan. The difference from advocacy to what would yield an intolerable strain is when that advocacy transforms into a tangible effect on the investigation itself, which actually dictates what evidence is collected and what evidence is not collected.
So this is just, and again, it's an odd question, but like, what duty does the Special Victims Council have to the defendant? Is it the same as the trial counsel?
Your Honor, this court in Andrews articulated that every attorney in the military justice process owes a duty to the process to uphold its integrity. And our position would be the integrity of the military justice process would be offended when attorneys involved in the process actively try to influence what evidence an independent federal law enforcement investigation agency wants to receive in their independent investigation. Now, Your Honor, we talked a little bit about intent on behalf of the counsel in the United States versus Boyce. Intent is not the relevant inquiry. Judge Sparks, you asked about the other witness on the patio who saw the text message. That witness surely would not have been privy to the phone call that occurred later that night. I'd like to talk about United States versus Proctor, which is the most recent UCI opinion this court has issued. That was raised as an apparent UCI case, but if we can recall oral argument from that case, former Chief Judge Stuckey talked to counsel about how this case screamed of actual UCI. It was just raised as apparent UCI. And that's true. And in a case like that, it would make perfect sense for this court to place special emphasis on the personal prejudice prong. Whereas in this case, which lives in the legacy of Boyce, it's all about the public's perception of the fairness of the system as a whole. Personal prejudice, of course, can be considered, but it's not determinative or the most weighty.
What do you do about the Bergdahl case, right, where we marched through the lack of personal prejudice? That was an apparent UCI case.
Your Honor, it's of course a consideration, but it's not a determinative consideration.
What was determinative in that case?
There
was five judges on the court that all agreed that there was evidence of apparent UCI.
Your Honor, I would distinguish that case on the fact that ours is misconduct committed by judge advocates. Your Honor, may I please finish the question?
Please continue.
And the difference between Boyce or Bergdahl or even Proctor, where there are other actors in the military justice system who are committing the influence on the system. In this case, we have attorneys, we have JAGs like Lewis, Salyer, and Barry, the people who should know best that it's the mortal enemy of military justice, who are directly applying influence to the system itself. Thank you, Your Honor.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will be in recess until 10:45.